You're listening to the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi.
Featuring clinical and forensic psychologist Joni Johnston.
Corey Richens, she is the mom. The mom who was flipping houses, who, by accounts of many, especially if you just recently watched the 48 Hours special, was at the height of her career, height of her relationship. Everything was going fine when suddenly her husband, Eric Richens, dies of an overdose of fentanyl after drinking a Moscow Mule. Was this an overdose that was self-inflicted on accident by Eric himself? Was this a poisoning? Because maybe the relationship wasn't just as hunky-dory as some would make it out to be. Joining me to discuss, Dr. Joni Johnston, forensic psychologist. This is one that we've been watching closely from the beginning and lots of opinions on every side. What are your thoughts on this case as to where it sits right now? Obviously, we have an upcoming trial, but both sides arguing their points pretty strongly as to innocence or guilt.
You know, there have been few cases that I can remember where two sides have such completely different accounts of a relationship before somebody dies. I mean, of course, when you have the prosecution and the defense, or you have the victim's family and you have the alleged perpetrator's family, you're going to hear different stories. But this really does seem to be extreme to some extent. I mean, you have the Richens family, Corey's family, saying this was a guy who was doing some drugs. They had a great relationship. He was completely behind flipping, buying this, you know, elaborate house, huge house, and things were great. And then you have, you know, Eric's family saying it was terrible. He was getting ready to divorce her.
Yeah.
He tried to, you know, she tried to poison him before. I mean, just, you know, he did not want her to buy this house. They were fighting over it. I mean, it really is incredible. The two almost diametrically opposed versions that you have of this particular case. You know, I'm going to leave it up to the jury in terms of innocence or guilt. I do think that the letter that was recovered in her, or in her prison cell, was certainly something that I thought was did not look very favorable to her, and so I think she's going to have a tough road to hoe.
I mean, when she goes to trial. Yeah, I mean that letter, that was one real damning piece that seemed to come into play. I mean, obviously after the fact of the murder or the suicide or the accidental overdose, whatever it actually was, that, you know, didn't need to dig her the hole even further that she was already going down. It seemed to be kind of a veiled attempt at communicating with her family about what she'd want them to testify to, or the story that she wanted them to follow along with. What's your take on that? I mean, is she just that dumb that she thought that this wouldn't be found, or that this, I mean, anything that comes and goes out of the prison is going to have someone be taking a look at, especially something this high profile? Again, was this just someone obviously who didn't have a lot of experience being in prison, not really realizing the extent as to what is looked at when trying to communicate with the outside?
You know, I think we've said this before to each other, Tony. It's astonishing.
Yeah.
It's astonishing how many times we hear recordings of prison conversations, of jail conversations, where there's bright red lights and signs that say your phone call will be recorded, and yet people just ignore that. And certainly we know that Corey Richens is not a hardened criminal. This is not somebody with an extensive criminal record. And so, you know, she obviously was not thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of, you know, her cell could be searched at any point in time. People can, you don't have privacy when you're in prison. So you can't say, this is my room, right? Don't go in it. And so, you know, I think the other interesting part of that is, I think it does not only hurt her credibility, I think it hurts her family's credibility. Because I was thinking, you know, the fact that you're writing a letter to your family and basically saying, this is how I'd like you to testify. I mean, I can tell you, I think if I was in that situation, I wouldn't even think of writing a letter to my mom like that, because I would know that she would never do that, or my brother would never do that. They would love me, support me, care about me, but they wouldn't lie, and they wouldn't spin a certain story.
Yeah.
And so I think it damages, in some respects, it spills over to her family.
Were you at all surprised by the diametrically opposing stories from both families? Or is it not that surprising at all, where if you're in a relationship that may be on the rocks, you're probably not going to your mother-in-law and saying, hey, I think your daughters might be trying to kill me, or vice versa of whatever, you know, issues you may have with your partner, which is why both of them were almost in the dark and they're just believing whatever, you know, their respective child is telling them.
I think that's definitely part of it, Tony. I also wonder if just the current circumstances have magnified that. Mm-hmm. You know, meaning I guarantee you, if you talk to both parents, for example, Eric's mom, you know, Corey's mom, you would get different perspectives of mm-hmm. their marriage, because we do talk to our parents. And of course, our parents love us and want to take our sides and see things through our viewpoint. But I do think that just the extent to which their versions are so different at this point in terms of, you know, attempted murder on the one hand and great relationship on the other. No drug use. Yes, this person was using recreational drugs, you know, routinely. I mean, I think those things have likely been colored to some extent with the proceedings and mm-hmm. and with Eric's murder.
And that can't be easy for either side to hear the other side and reckon it with reality. You know, obviously, one, you're going to want to believe your daughter is innocent, that she didn't do these sort of things. The other, you're going to want justice for your son. You're going to believe if your son's coming to you, coming to you're his brother and saying, look, if something happens to me, look at her, and then something happens to him, and they do look at her, and it doesn't look all that good. How are you squaring up the fentanyl? Because it's already pretty much been determined where it's come from. The friend that was a friend of Corey that she got it from, you know, was she getting it from for recreational use? Why did she have that much to begin with? There was also her own prescription drugs in his system. Either this is someone, seemingly the picture they're trying to paint is someone who liked to use a lot of different types of drugs, not just recreationally. But, you know, does it really appear to be that way? And is it all that common for it to play out in that sort of a way?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, when I said there are diametrically opposed viewpoints, which I think that there are, I don't mean that both of them are necessarily equally true.
Sure.
Or equally valid. So then it becomes a matter of looking at the evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, so what does the evidence support? You know, if Eric is somebody who's recreationally using fentanyl or using drugs, did anybody else know this? Did anybody else notice this? Mm-hmm. How is he functioning at work? How is his work performance? I mean, there's all kinds of things that we would expect to see or not see.
Sure.
You know, is there a history of him using drugs? Did he buy drugs from anybody else? You know, if we can't find evidence of that, mm-hmm. right, then we're starting to say, okay, yeah, these might be two diametrically opposed stories, but one of them seems to have more evidence to support it mm-hmm. and the other one doesn't. Or if one person is now changing their name of a beneficiary or changing their estate or whatever, you know, that certainly implies either that they're not happy or they're somehow, you know, suspicious of the other. It implies something is not right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think when you look at the fentanyl, I haven't heard, just based on what's kind of been out in the public, a lot of evidence that Eric was somebody who was a drug user, and that he would be somebody who would recreationally use fentanyl or would choose in any way, shape, or form to use it. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the evidence of who purchased this fentanyl, I think it starts becoming very problematic for Corey.
Do you think this is going to be a difficult one to convict her on? Or, I mean, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence here. Do you think there's going to be too many questions that will raise reasonable doubt at the end of the day from what we know thus far?
You know, juries are very hard to predict, which is why I'm glad I'm not an attorney. But I think if I had to bet at this point, which I would never do, to bet on anybody's freedom, I would bet that Corey is going to get convicted.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens between now and when we actually have a trial date. What more comes out of that cell, because more continues to apparently come out.
Want to listen ad-free? Want advanced access to all of our interviews before anyone else?
Become a True Crime Today Premium Plus subscriber on Apple Podcasts.
You get every episode commercial-free,
so you can binge on true crime
until you can binge no more.
Search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts now, or go to our podcast page and sign up now.
More of the Hidden Killers podcast next.